Okay, good morning, everybody. This is File 241. It's October 27th. We're finishing up the endocrine chapter. We're going to move on to muscles today. And, okay, you guys that are yakking, you can yak, but not too loud, all right, because there's some students that want to hear what's happening in here. And so we're going to finish up endocrine chapter, move on to muscles today. So endocrine is 11, muscles are 12, and then we have a test Tuesday, right? We do have test number 3 on Tuesday. All right, so does anybody have any question on endocrine system? No questions. All right, fantastic. We were talking about the pancreas last time. No, thyroid gland, sorry, thyroid gland. All right, thyroid gland in the neck, make sure you know where it is. Make sure you know the trophic hormone that controls the thyroid gland, which is the, what's the name of the hormone that causes the thyroid gland to hypertrophy, to grow, and also secrete thyroid hormone? Yeah, thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH. Where does that come from? The anterior pituitary. So you should have a list of hormones from the pituitary, both the posterior pituitary and anterior pituitary. And how does the anterior pituitary know when to release thyroid stimulating hormone? Because somebody tells it. Who tells it? The hypothalamus. And what's the signal that the hypothalamus sends? Yeah, releasing factor, another hormone. And how does TSH releasing hormone or releasing factor get to the anterior pituitary from the hypothalamus? Yeah, the hypothalamal hypophyseal portal, a blood vessel, so it goes by the circulatory system, right? But how are hormones released from the posterior pituitary? So let's step away from the thyroid gland for a second and think about the posterior pituitary. How does the posterior pituitary know when to release hormones? It's an electrical signal, right? There are action potentials that come down from the hypothalamus into the posterior pituitary. When those action potentials reach those axon termini, then they release either oxytocin or ADH. So what's named the physical pathway that those action potentials take? Is it the portal blood vessel? No, it's a tract, right? It's a hypothalamo hypophyseal tract that carries those action potentials down there. Okay. That's a pretty good review. So not only does the thyroid gland release thyroid-stimulating hormone, but there are there's four little glands called parathyroid glands embedded in the thyroid gland. I don't have a picture, but your anatomy book does. And it releases parathyroid hormone because it has receptors for blood calcium levels. And you can probably imagine from what you've studied so far in this class that blood calcium homeostasis is very important, right? Not only for homeostasis of bones, but for synaptic transmission, for second messenger systems, for signal transduction in various cells. And then we're going to get to muscles, and you're going to see calcium is real important for muscles as well. All right, so parathyroid hormone can sense decreasing blood calcium levels. And when it does, it releases parathyroid hormone. Parathyroid hormone has two effects. One effect is on the kidneys. So what does the kidney have in order to be sensitive to parathyroid hormone? Yeah, it's got to have receptors, right? And bone is sensitive to parathyroid hormone. So there are cells in bone, all right, that have receptors. And, all right, let's go back to the kidneys first. Right, so parathyroid hormone then causes the kidneys to resorb calcium. And resorption is, we haven't studied the kidney yet, but resorption is the process of taking something from the fluid that will become urine, which is what we call filtrate. We'll take something that will be excreted from your body and put it back in the blood. So it decreases urinary excretion of calcium. So resorption is taking something that's in urine and putting it back in your body. That's what resorption is. Taking something that's in urine, for instance, and then putting it back in your body. And so if that takes calcium from the product that's going to be urine, puts it back in your body, what happens to blood calcium levels then? It increases as a result. All right, and so this is a response by the kidneys. What was the initial stimulus? Decreasing blood calcium, and how does the response compare to the stimulus? They subtract from each other, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism that maintains, that helps to maintain blood calcium homeostasis. All right, now let's look at the bone. Bone over here becomes stimulated, and it causes, parathyroid hormone causes dissolution or demineralization of bone. And that calcium ends up in the blood, so again, that's the response, and you see that it subtracts from the initial stimulus. All right, but what happens to bone when that happens? It gets weaker and more brittle when that happens. But it's much more important, your body realizes, to have blood calcium homeostasis rather than strong bones. All right, you might not like that, because what happens, what's that disease process when bones start to demineralize, when you lose calcium and they become brittle? Osteoporosis, right? So that's the result partially of this parathyroid hormone. But can you tell me the name of the cells that are responsible for dissolving bone? Osteo something, because osteo means bone, but osteo what? Okay, osteoclasts. And bone homeostasis is maintained by the action of two kinds of cells. Osteoclasts break bone down, and osteoblast builds bone up, right? But under the influence of parathyroid hormone, that balance is shifted in favor of breaking bone down, right? But you can kind of counteract that effect. How can you counteract that effect in your daily life? Because we don't want osteoporosis in us or any of our family members. How can you fight osteoporosis? Making sure that your calcium intake is adequate in your diet, but you also need a vitamin to make sure that you can absorb calcium from your digestive tract, and that is vitamin D, all right? That's important. But there's something else. There's a third thing. So diet is important so that you have proper calcium and vitamin D, but there's something else that is just as important, and that is exercise. That's right, because when you stress a bone, just like when you stress a muscle gets stronger. When you stress a bone by exercise, guess what happens to that bone? It gets stronger too. It gets bigger, right? That's why there are processes on bones where muscles attach to bones. All right, so that is a very important thing. Those three things are real important to maintain healthy bones. And then it will maintain healthy blood calcium levels. Okay, there's another hormone that I don't have a slide to show you. All right, parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium. But there's another hormone that decreases blood calcium when it's too high, and that's called calcitonin. All right, and I think you should just jot that down in your notes, that the action of parathyroid hormone and calcitonin are what? Antagonistic to each other, right? And it's through that antagonism, just like you have osteoblasts and osteoclasts, through that antagonism, it's much easier to maintain blood calcium homeostasis. So that is one hormone pair that work through antagonism, but you should be really familiar with that concept of antagonism. All right, so that kind of introduces then the next organ that we're going to talk about, and that is the pancreas. And the pancreas is involved with regulating blood glucose or maintaining blood glucose homeostasis. And the part of the pancreas, remember the pancreas has two divisions to it. It has an exocrine division and an endocrine division. Can anybody tell me anything about the exocrine division or exocrine division of the pancreas? What does it make and secrete? Yeah, digestive enzymes for proteins and lipase and amylase. Lipase for lipids, amylase for starches, complex sugars. Okay, that's the exocrine part, because those digestive enzymes are secreted by the pancreas into a duct, right? And then that duct carries them to the digestive tract where they have their action. Okay, under normal circumstances, that's a good thing. But in between the duct system are the islets of Langerhans of the pancreas. So here is the nice pancreas. You can see the pancreatic duct very nicely. And if we look inside the pancreas, we can see some cells that aren't secreting into the duct system. And so these are the endocrine cells. And their product is secreted and picked up by the blood vessels, which then distribute these signaling compounds all over the body. There are two kinds of hormones that the pancreas secretes, and one is called insulin. You're maybe familiar with that. And the second is glucagon, and they are antagonistic to each other. right? So one increases blood glucose and the other decreases blood glucose. Do you know right off the bat which one decreases blood glucose? Okay, insulin. Yeah, and if somebody has normal insulin receptors and normal insulin metabolism or glucose metabolism in cells, insulin will definitely decrease blood glucose. So that means glucagon does what? Increases blood glucose. Yeah, it increases blood glucose. And so let's look at some of these cells. So the islets contain what we know are alpha cells and beta cells. The alpha cells secrete glucagon and the beta cells secrete insulin. So these beta cells are active under what kind of conditions if it secretes insulin? When blood glucose is high. What kind of state are you in when blood in a normal individual when blood glucose is high? We call that the fed state. Okay, I don't know. I couldn't quite hear what some students said. But what did you say? Oh, yeah, hyperglycemia. Okay, but I would like to say when you're in the fed state, when glucose is leaving your digestive system, going into the blood, when you're absorbing glucose, okay, and then insulin decreases, the secretion of insulin decreases when you're not in the fed state, when you're in a fasted state. So think fed and fasted, the two kind of states that you're in. Okay. All right, so let's see. Next slide. All right, so alpha secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose. And glucagon stimulates glycogenolysis and lipolysis. Where's the primary source of glycogenolysis? Yeah, in the liver, because the liver can break down glycogen into glucose, because glucose is the building block of glycogen, and the liver is the only organ that when glycogen is broken down can secrete glucose, right? It has glucose 6-phosphatase that can chop off a phosphate off of glucose, and then it can leave through the plasma membrane and go into the blood. All right, so glycogenolysis increases blood glucose, and even lipolysis will help with maintaining at least ATP concentration, right, because of beta oxidation. Right, lipids can't be used to make make glucose, but at least that helps your energy balance in terms of ATP. All right, the beta cells, on the other hand, secrete insulin in response to high blood glucose. For instance, during the fed state, right, that promotes entry of glucose into cells because it activates those GLUT4 transporters. Or actually, a better way of saying it is what? It inserts active GLUT4 transporters that are held in reserve in those endosomes. And the endosomes fuse with the plasma membrane. That was a slide earlier in the chapter when we looked at the tyrosine kinase receptor. And then those facilitated diffusion transporters work and cells can take up glucose. Insulin also promotes the conversion of glucose into glycogen and fat in cells, so that when a muscle cell takes up glucose, right, it can't secrete it again. And if the muscle is not active, then it takes that glucose, stores it in the form of glycogen, or it can be used to make fatty acids. And when glucose leaves the blood, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It decreases, right? Okay, so those are the effects of insulin. So here's a nice feedback loop that we're going to look at. If the stimulus is an increase in blood glucose, and under what conditions would that happen? What kind of state? A fed state, okay, like first thing in the morning when you have breakfast, orange juice, all that kind of stuff. Blood glucose goes up. The pancreas, and in particular the beta cells in the pancreatic islets, see and can monitor an increase in blood glucose. They respond by secreting insulin, which is what, the passport of entry for glucose into most cells, if the tyrosine kinase receptor system is working properly. So that increases cellular uptake of blood glucose. And then those cells can take that glucose and make glycogen out of it in the liver and skeletal muscle. And they could also take that glucose and make fatty acids and triglycerides. Because glycerol, can you tell me about glycerol? Just as kind of a fun review. What can you tell me about glycerol? How many carbons does it have? Yeah, it's got 3. Glycerol's got 3. And how many does glucose have? It's got six, right? So in order to make glycerol, all you have to do is what? Chop glucose in half, and you have a precursor for triglycerides, as long as you make some fatty acids to go along with it, right? So glycolysis can make glycerol very easily, and that happens in adipose tissue. All right, so when cells take up glucose, that decreases blood glucose. How does that correspond to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it. So this is a nice negative feedback loop right here that maintains glucose homeostasis in the blood. All right, so this probably is an exam figure. Oh, and that's it for this chapter. Okay, so endocrine system is done. So can you tell me the names of at least two pairs of hormones that work antagonistically to each other to maintain homeostasis? Okay, I should take my little earpiece out, but I don't want to. So raise your hand if you know at least one pair of hormones that work antagonistically with each other. Yeah. Yeah, calcitonin and parathyroid hormone for what metabolite? Actually, it's not a metabolite. It's just a electrolyte. Calcium. It's for calcium, blood calcium levels, yeah? Okay, what's another pair of hormones that work antagonistically to each other? Yeah, insulin and glucagon work on, and this is a metabolite. What metabolite is it controlling? Glucose, yeah. Blood glucose homeostasis. All right, let's see if I can think of any others. Cortisol and aldosterone. Not really antagonistic to each other. One is involved in regulating electrolytes like aldosterone, okay, and the other is helping regulate glucose. So they're a little bit different, but they both come from the adrenal cortex. Yeah, so just a little. One's a mineralocorticoid, the other's a glucocorticoid. Antidiuretic hormone. We haven't talked about those. Or we did talk about ADH, antidiuretic hormone, and there is a hormone that's antagonistic to antidiuretic hormone. And it is, maybe I mentioned it, it's called atrial natriuretic hormone. I think maybe I did mention it in passing. Atrial natriuretic hormone and ADH are antagonistic to each other. So it's kind of nice to have a little framework, I think, in your mind. Because that reinforces the concept of what? Balance, how your body finds balance. And that's always a critical thing in the clinical environment. How do you restore balance or health to an individual? Okay? Okay. All right, so next. Next. I would like a cursor. Come on, cursor. Where are you? There you are. All right, so the next chapter is muscle. And that's chapter 12. Chapter 12. Ah, there it is. Okay. Mechanisms of contraction and neural control. Let's see what we got here. My cursor is about dying. My mouse is dying. I don't understand what's happening. Okay, so just maybe a quick review. You should know the hierarchical structural arrangements of the structures that make muscle, all the way down to the molecular layer. So here we have a bone. Oh, please, cursor, come on. Okay, so here we have a bone and skeletal muscle. Well, why do we call it skeletal muscle? Because it's attached to the skeleton, right? It's attached to bone. So skeletal muscle makes bones move. And so a skeletal muscle is really the only muscle that is voluntary, that you have voluntary control of, right? It's under your voluntary control. So a muscle can't push, it can only pull. Right, muscles can only shorten and develop tension, and here is a whole muscle like the biceps brachii, for instance, or brachialis or brachioradialis, and there is a connective tissue sheath, right, that covers the whole muscle. We call that fascia, and underneath the fascia is another connective tissue layer that we call the epimysium. Epi just means on top of. There's also some connective tissue, a membrane that surrounds the bone, and that's called the periosteum. This is kind of a nice review. And as this muscle attaches to bone, all of these connective tissues merge together and attach to each other, and it forms a nice secure attachment of this muscle that's going to shorten to the bone right here. All right, but if we have the whole muscle, we can see that it is made up of building blocks, these big bundles right here. And the bundles are what we call fascicles, right? So fascicles is like one of the fundamental building blocks of a muscle. And a fascicle has building blocks too, which I see right here, each of these little red dots. That represents a muscle cell. And a skeletal muscle cell is kind of special. It's not like many cells in your body because they're tremendously long and narrow. So it kind of looks like a fiber. And as a matter of fact, people call muscle cells muscle fibers interchangeably. And the reason why it looks like a fiber is because during development, hundreds of individual muscle cells fuse together to form this big, long, cylindrical fiber. And as a result of that, a muscle fiber today in our bodies has many, many nuclei, maybe hundreds of nuclei, and these come from each of the individual muscle cells or myoblasts that fuse together to make this muscle fiber that's working in our body today. All right, so here is a muscle fiber. And around every muscle fiber, around every fascicle is the perimysium. And as you get to the end of the muscle, the perimysium fuses with the epimysium, right? And it fuses with the fascia. And so the whole muscle pulls together. Around every single muscle fiber is some more connective tissue that we call the endomysium. And then at the end of the muscle fiber that fuses with the perimysium, which fuses with the epimysium, right? So again, all of these things kind of pull together when something shortens inside a muscle fiber. All right, so here we have an individual, come on, cursor, an individual muscle cell. How about if it works up over here? Maybe not. Maybe it will work on my piece of paper. I might have to give you your mouse pad back. It's not working today for some reason. Okay, that seems to be better. All right, so here we have a fascicle, and inside a fascicle are each of the individual fibers, and let's pull out one fiber, and you can see some more tubular structures inside this cell, right? And these are the organelles for contraction. The organelles for contraction are called myofibrils, right? So a muscle fiber has many, many myofibrils, many nuclei. And there's another organelle, which I don't see on this diagram right here, that you should realize that this muscle fiber has in it. What's another organelle that it should have? What does a muscle cell need to contract? Yeah, it needs ATP. And what's the organelle that produces ATP? Yeah, mitochondria, right? So this muscle fiber should also be loaded with mitochondria. And I don't think I see that on this diagram right here. When we think of the plasma membrane of a skeletal muscle cell, we call it the sarcolemma. And the cytoplasm inside a skeletal muscle cell is called the sarcoplasm. All right, and one way that you can tell that this is a skeletal muscle cell, because when I look at it, I see these stripes, which we call striations. So there's a repeating pattern of some kind of molecule inside the muscle cell that gives the cell striations. Right, and it's contained within the organelles for contraction, which are the myofibrils. So the myofibrils even have some building blocks that you should know about, and they're called myofilaments or filaments. And I just see a couple filaments right here sticking out. All right, so what's the building block of a myofibril? They're myofilaments, okay? And if you put a bunch of myofibrils together, what do you get? You get a muscle fiber, and if you put a bunch of muscle fibers together, what do you get? A fascicle, and if you put a bunch of fascicles together, what do you get? You get the whole muscle, okay? All right, so try to appreciate that organization within muscles. So I think we're going to, I see some very nice striations right here, all right? So this is, I know skeletal muscle because it's just, not, it's just a linear, long muscle right here. It doesn't have any branches to it, and I see striation. So that's a nice dead giveaway. Okay, neuromuscular junction. It's a synapse. All right, so you have to know what kind of synapses. What are the two main categories of synapses? So you got electrical and chemical. And so we got to figure out which one, what kind of synapse skeletal muscle is made up of. So what about an electrical synapse? What do you think about an electrical synapse in terms of, what's the utility of an electrical synapse? If one cell is excited by depolarization, what happens to neighboring cells? Yeah, they're also excited by depolarization, right? So that means that if we had electrical synapses between all of the muscle cells in our body, you could just cause one skeletal muscle to contract, and then what would happen to all the skeletal muscles in your body? They would all contract as a result, right? Which would be, well, be ineffective, because you'd reach out to grab a glass of water and your whole body would go into contracture, right? So that certainly wouldn't work. So these are chemical synapses, which then means that you have control over which muscle fibers are going to contract and which are going to stay relaxed. Okay, so here is a somatic motor neuron. Oh, it says right there, nice, somatic motor neuron. So what can you tell me about the name, somatic motor? All right, somatic means going where? Okay, somatic literally means your body, okay, but it really means the surface of your body outside body cavities, right, outside visceral body cavities. So somatic means outside visceral body cavities, and you have your musculoskeletal system there. And motor just means what? It's not sensory. It's sending, this neuron is sending signals from the central nervous system, okay, out to the periphery. That's what that means, to skeletal muscle. And skeletal muscles are the only things that you have voluntary control of in your whole body. All right, so then we have the axon terminus. Right, you see that it's highly branched. And this whole, I might see if I can't get this cursor here. I can move this one, but the buttons don't work. But I can use my other one if I want to press a button. Okay. All right, so this right here, this whole extent of the all these bifurcations, right, this is the like the Bouton terminale, right? So there are synaptic vesicles in this whole extent of the axon terminus right here. It's just not the tip that we saw in a typical kind of multipolar neuron. So this synapse is huge, right? Because like an axodendritic or an axosomatic nerve ending, the Bouton would just be a little pip on the axon terminus right here. But all of these branches right here contain synaptic vesicles that is going to release neurotransmitters. So the synapse is huge. So every time an action potential comes down an axon, it releases so much neurotransmitter that it always reaches threshold in this region, in the neuromuscular junction. So the skeletal muscle, okay, is always excited. It always depolarizes and produces action potentials, which means then that this muscle is always going to contract when action potentials reach this axon terminus right here. So that's one difference about the neuromuscular junction to a regular chemical synapse in the nervous system someplace. Okay, another distinction is that these synaptic endings right here on the neuron actually invaginate, go into the muscle cell a little bit, right? And that helps anchor the neuron to the muscle cell. Because when a muscle cell gets excited, what does it do? Yeah, it moves. It likes to move out of the way. So it could pull away from, right, this somatic motor neuron right here. So the neuromuscular junction has other features compared to the synapse that stabilizes the physical association between the neuron and the muscle cell so that they don't pull apart. Okay, so you can see a lot of mitochondria. That's good. You can see a lot of synaptic vesicles right here. And also, here's another distinction. If, say, this postsynaptic cell right here was a neuron, what kind of receptors for neurotransmitter and what kind of channels would you find in this region if it was just a neuron-neuron synapse as opposed to a neuron-muscle synapse? What kind of channels would you have around the synaptic cleft right here? Would you have voltage-gated channels or ligand-gated channels is what I'm asking. Okay, so ligand-gated channels, and let's just say that this is a dendrite, where would you have to go to find your first voltage-gated channels? You'd have to have that graded potential move all the way down the dendrite over the cell body to, right, the axon before it bumps into a voltage-gated channel. But on muscle cells, there are voltage-gated channels within the neuromuscular junction, and there's a high density just outside the neuromuscular junction, so these graded potentials don't have to travel very far to excite what? An action potential on the surface of a muscle cell. All right, so an action potential then will travel down the whole extent of the muscle cell on the sarcolemma because the whole cell has voltage-gated channels as well as some ligand-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction. All right, so any kind of depolarization in the neuromuscular junction then will trigger these voltage-gated channels, which again is another reason why skeletal muscle can't make up its own mind whether or not it's going to contract. All right, so those are three important distinctions between the neuromuscular junction and a regular neuron-neuron synapse. And the neuromuscular junction is so big that it's easy to see them even underneath the light microscope. So here is the neuromuscular junction, and you can even see myelination on these somatic motor neurons coming from the central nervous system. Okay, so the neuromuscular junction has special adherence features to it that we call the motor end plate. It has not only ligand-gated channels, but it has voltage-gated channels, so that an action potential can develop immediately in this area that is then going to travel over the whole muscle cell. And if you have an action potential developing in the neuromuscular junction, what happens to that action potential by the time it reaches the end of the muscle fiber? Which is huge, because remember, a muscle fiber is made up of hundreds of, right, individual muscle cells. What can you tell me about that action potential as it's traveling over the muscle cell, the muscle fiber? Does it die away or not? No, because action potentials travel without decrement, right? So that's going to excite the whole muscle cell. All right, now what about if this muscle cell where I have the cursor is excited and there's action potentials flowing over the whole cell up and down, what about these neighboring cells? Do they become excited? No, because there are what? No electrical synapses between them, only chemical synapses which are controlled by these somatic motor neurons. Okay, so let's look at a motor unit. That's important to understand. Okay, so here we have a muscle like the biceps brachii, and we have the nice ventral root right here, and the ventral root is motor, sending these motor neurons, somatic motor neurons, down to the skeletal muscle. All right, and a muscle fiber itself, when it's told to contract, will contract with 100% of its ability. Okay, and then it relaxes. So you might say, well, gee whiz, how is it then that when I contract my biceps, I can control the degree of tension that that biceps is producing, right? And that's because of this concept of motor unit right here. When the biceps contracts, it doesn't mean that every single fiber contracts, right? But only a few fibers in that muscle if you want to perform what we call a graded contraction. A graded is something between 100% and zero. So for instance, if you're picking up a feather that's very light, you need very, very few muscle fibers to contract. But if you're picking up a bowling ball, okay, then you need what? More muscle fibers to contract to pick up that higher weight. All right, so a motor unit is defined as a single motor neuron and then all of the muscle fibers that it innervates. All right, so in particular, let's look at this one right over here. How many muscle fibers are innervated by this one somatic motor neuron? It's only three. All right, so this would produce a relatively weak contraction. Let's compare it with this somatic motor neuron right here. If an action potential comes down here, how many muscle fibers are going to contract? Oh, I see three. I see six. I see nine. I see 10. All right, that's close. All right, so if this somatic motor neuron sends action potentials, will it produce a stronger contraction or a weaker contraction compared to this one down over here? It's going to be a lot stronger, right? As a matter of fact, three times as strong. All right, and if that doesn't even produce, if this motor neuron is relaxed, all right, but this one is active, right, that produces a relatively stronger contraction, there's a way to make even a stronger contraction. How is that? You can recruit, not only send action potentials down this first motor neuron, but you can also recruit this second one that's going to add force to the contraction of the biceps. And then if you need even a stronger contraction, you can recruit a third motor unit and a fourth and a fifth, right? So the concept of recruitment is activating multiple motor units to produce stronger contractions. And then the strongest contraction would be when all of the muscle fibers are excited into contraction. All right, so when a motor neuron is activated, all muscle fibers in the motor unit contract to 100% of their ability, but nonetheless, a muscle, you still have graded control of that contraction because you can activate or deactivate different motor units. The number of motor fibers in a motor unit varies according to the degree of fine control that you need in that part of your body, right? And we call that the innervation ratio, which is the number of motor neurons that innervate the number of muscle fibers. And it varies from 1 to 100 to 1 to 2,000. So 1 to 100, right, that the innervation ratio is small right here, when you need fine control, like for instance, your hand motions. And the ratio is really small, for instance, in postural muscles where you don't need to have a lot of dexterity. So you have one motor neuron and that's going to innervate a lot of different muscle fibers. Okay, and I think we talked about recruitment already. Yeah, the brain kind of estimates the number of motor units that are required just by your visual inspection of something to contract, and it can activate more motor units or even deactivate motor units if the movement of your body is inappropriate, and probably most of us have experienced this to some degree. And I think of a time, maybe you were at a restaurant and they like to serve water to people when you're sitting at a restaurant, you know, so they ask you now, would you like water? And everybody says yes. And so sometimes they bring over a pitcher of water with some big glass mugs, right, and they fill these big glass mugs, and you reach for a glass mug and you lift it up, and all of a sudden it starts flying off the table, and it's like you're going to spill it on your neighbor because it's not a glass mug. What kind of mug is it? It's a big plastic mug that's not even half as heavy as the glass mug, right? So your visual inspection said, oh, I needed a lot of motor units to lift this heavy object, but then all of a sudden your body is acting wild, and your cerebellum realizes what's happening, and it shuts down some motor units, and everybody's saved as a result of that. Okay. All right, structure of a muscle fiber. What did we say the organelle of contraction is? Is the myofibril. Okay, so myofibrils, you put a bunch of myofibrils together, you get a muscle fiber. All right, myofibrils are pretty small, about 1 micron in diameter, so that means you can pack a lot of these in, maybe 10 or 20 within a muscle fiber cell. And as a matter of fact, if we look at a myofibril, all right, we said that it has some building blocks as well, and we call these things myofilaments. And there are two major kinds of myofilaments inside of a muscle cell. There are thick ones and thin ones. And the thick ones block a lot of light, so they look dark. And certain places within the myofibril, you only have thin filaments, so it lets a lot of light pass through it, and that forms a light band. So you have dark bands and light bands, and these keep repeating over and over and over and over again, okay, made up of the thick and thin filaments. The thick filaments are what we call myosin. All right, so here's a thick filament. That's myosin. The thin filaments are made out of actin. And there is a repeating unit within the myofibril, and it repeats itself from Z-disc to Z-disc. All right, and the actin is attached to the Z-disc right over here. All right, so why do you think maybe this was called the Z-disc? I don't know for sure, but I can imagine why it's called the Z-disc. Because Z is what letter of the alphabet? It's the last one. It's the end point. And the Z-disc here is the end point of this repeating structure, and that repeating structure is called the sarcomere. Oh, start here. I must have started there one semester. All right, so this is what we want to know. We want to study this structure between the Z-discs because it's the structural and functional unit of contraction. in skeletal muscle and even in cardiac muscle. And since it's so important, we call it the sarcomere. All right, so here is the sarcomere. So the building blocks of sarcomere are actin and myosin and some other proteins in here. So let's look at these different spaces. This light zone, right, that I see right here, it actually goes across the Z-disc. That's called the I-band. So that's pretty easy to remember because I is also in what? In light, right? So here's the light band. And then wherever you have myosin molecules right over here, we call that the A-band. And again, that's really easy to remember because what vowel do you have in dark? A, right? All right, but that's not exactly how it was named, but that's close enough for you to remember that you got I-bands and A-bands. Okay, notice that the actin doesn't go all the way across and touch each other. So there are some places where actin and myosin overlap, and that's a really dark area. All right, and then some places you just have myosin, not quite as dark. If you look at the micrograph, the electron micrograph right here, you have between within the dark band right in the center, you don't have any actin, so it looks a little bit lighter than the remaining part of the A band, so we call that the H zone. There are some other proteins that hold the myosin in place, right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. All right, and then, of course, the actin is attached to the Z discs, nice and tight. All right, so those are some structural features. Notice the overlap between actin and myosin right here. So when a muscle contracts, all of these sarcomeres shorten all throughout the whole length of the myofibril. All right, so a good question you could have is, gee whiz, when the myofibril contracts, which of these proteins actually shorten? Which one of these things contract? Because the sarcomere contracts. All right, so let's take a look and see what happens. But before we analyze that situation, all right, we see that. Let's look at a three-dimensional view, right? Because here is a sarcomere in a one-dimensional view. This is what it looks like in three dimensions. So let's cut a myofibril and look at it on end. And this is what we have. Okay, we have thick filaments, where I have the cursor right here, a little bit small, but you can see that that's a thick filament. What protein is that thick filament? That's myosin. And what is it completely surrounded with? These little dots. What are the little dots? They're actin. Okay, and if you look at an actin molecule, what's it surrounded by? Myosin, right? So they completely surround each other. Think in three dimensions. So I want you to have that picture in your mind. All of these filaments surround each other. So there's going to be a special kind of interaction between them because they surround each other. All right, so we're still working on which ones of these things shorten. Okay, so this probably is the exam figure that you should know. Right here we have the sarcomere. You got thick filaments, thin filaments, and here's a last filament right here, titin, and it looks like a coiled spring. Okay, and titin acts like an elastic molecule so that when the sarcomere stretches, guess what? This titin molecule brings it back to its original length. So muscle has elasticity. When you stretch a muscle, it has a tendency to go back to its normal length. Also, when a muscle shortens, this titin filament right here has a tendency, what? To make the sarcomere go back to its original length as well. Right? So springs don't like to be pulled and they don't like to be pushed. That's what this titin molecule is. But titin by itself does not cause contraction. All right, it just maintains the normal length of this sarcomere right here. So how does a muscle fiber contract? Okay, it contracts because the organelles get shorter. What are the organelles for contraction again? Myofibrils. And what's the repeating unit within a myofibril from end to end is the sarcomere. All right, and a myofibril contracts because the sarcomeres get shorter, but not because the filaments actually get shorter, so it was a really nasty trick question that I tried to pose to you. It's because the filaments slide over each other. The thick and thin filaments slide over each other, and then the distance between the Z-discs, right, gets smaller and smaller. So let's look at this figure right here. we see a micrograph, and in the very center we line up the Z disks, right? So that's going to be like our origin for comparison. And when a muscle is at rest, the sarcomere is not contracted. We see a normal distance of the I band, right, and the A band. But as the muscle starts to contract, and how can you tell there's some contraction in this second micrograph right here? How can you tell it's contracting? Because the Z disks are getting closer together, right? So these Z disks line up, and now you don't have to travel as far to get to this first one over here. Okay, so let's compare. So the sarcomere is getting shorter. Do you believe that? I see that there. Now what about the myosin? We're going to compare the length of the myosin here and the length of the myosin, the length of the myosin here. What about the length of myosin? Is it shortening? It's not shortening. It's the same length. Okay, now let's look at the I band. Okay, and in the I band, we have actin. So here is the I band from here to here when it's relaxed. Now what about when it's contracting? What's happening to the I band? Looks a little bit smaller. So the I bands actually disappear. And then when the muscle is fully contracted, right, so here's the third picture. And of course, this is contracted because the Z disks are now really close together. What can you tell me about the I band? It's gone. Okay? So the I band disappears, and the myosin, which is here and here, is really the same length as here and here. So myosin doesn't contract, right? So the I band shorten, okay? And the A bands maybe get a little bit darker because the actin actually slips in between them. All right, there's something else that disappears, and that is, all right, this little H zone disappears as well, because now you have complete overlap. Let's look down at this slide over here. So now you see when a muscle is relaxed, you have a little bit of overlap between actin and myosin, and then you have more overlap when a sarcomere is partly contracted, but when it's fully contracted, you have complete overlap of actin and myosin. As a matter of fact, maybe even the myosin bumps into the Z disks over here. So there's really no I band whatsoever that's left. All right, so what can you tell me about the length of myosin in figure number 3 compared to figure number 2? Exactly the same length. What about the length of actin in figure number 3 compared to figure number 1? Exactly the same length. Okay, so this is what we call the sliding filament theory of muscle contraction. And when we say sliding filament theory, what does that mean? Yeah, the filaments are sliding over, but I'm thinking more about this word right here, theory. What does that mean? Yeah, it's been tested and proved in a lot of different laboratories, right? So this is something you can count on, okay, as being true. All right, so another way of thinking of this is if I have these two markers right here, and one marker is myosin and actin. When the muscle cell is relaxed, right, there's a little bit of overlap, and let's just say the Z disks are on either side. I could ask you, when a muscle contracts, does the blue or the red myofilament get shorter? You would say neither. You would say, well, how did the Z disks get closer together then? Okay, yeah, they just telescope or slide over each other just like that. Okay, that's the sliding filament mechanism. Okay. Oh, I think I was using this. No, I wasn't. Okay. Okay, let's go back and take a look. What was your question? The only thing that stays the same length is the A band. That's right. Right? The dark band, which is what? Myosin. That stays the same. But the Z disks do get closer to each other. Okay, so summary. I don't think I need to read the summary to you, but it's right there. It's just whatever we talked about so far. Okay, so how is it that these filaments, myofilaments, slide over each other? So we have to look at molecular level and the interaction between myosin and actin. All right, so here we have the thick filament, which is myosin, and it has these projections coming off of it, little processes, and we call this a head group. Right, and the head group has a little tail, and that makes up the myosin molecule. And these head groups, what completely encircle the myosin molecule, even though we're just kind of looking at it in one dimension right here. When a muscle is relaxed, this head group cannot associate with the actin molecule, which is this blue molecule right here. Okay, when the muscle is relaxed, the actin, well, I tell you what, when we go to my, let's finish analyzing myosin. All right, so you have the myosin tail, which pokes up off of the myosin filament, and then there's a head group right here. The head group has an active site where it can bind ATP, and not only that, but it's an ATPase. So it can break ATP down into ADP and inorganic phosphate, and when ATP is broken down, what happens to energy? Is it used up or is it given off when ATP is hydrolyzed? Yeah, it's given up, right? Because the hydrolysis of ATP is exergonic, which means it can drive some unfavorable reactions, maybe some kind of protein conformation change, something like that. All right, so the myosin head has a site for binding ATP, but it also has another site that can bind actin. Right, and what's the associate? Well, how would you explain the association of ATP to this myosin head group right here? How does ATP know that it can bind? It's just by shape, right? Just by the complementary shape of ATP and the active site on the myosin head group, right? How would you explain that this site right here can bind to actin? The same reason, right? Just because of the complementary shape of the actin binding site with some active site on the actin molecule. All right, so now let's look at actin. Actin, the basic molecule, is what we call G-actin or globular actin. All these little balls right here are globular actin. And in G-actin, there is a binding site for this myosin head group, which we can't see right at the moment, all right, because it's covered up by some other molecules. Let's look at the other molecules. There's something called troponin, right, that is interspersed every so often along the actin molecule, and troponin is a lot like calmodulin. It's a cousin molecule to calmodulin. What do you remember about calmodulin? That might be important for the test coming up. Calmodulin, what does it like to bind? It likes to bind calcium, right? And then when it binds calcium, it can change conformations in various enzymes, which maybe activate or inactivate them. So troponin will bind a calcium molecule, right? And then that can change a conformation with this third molecule that forms actin, and it's called tropomyosin. And when tropomyosin changes conformation, it reveals the binding site for this actin binding site on the myosin head group. All right, so in high concentrations of calcium, then myosin can actually bind to actin. And we call that a crossbridge. So here we have a crossbridge that's being formed right here. All right, so this crossbridge can form in the presence of calcium. Let me see what this next slide is. Okay. The power stroke. The power stroke is when this crossbridge articulates and actually flexes, right? And when it goes from a straight configuration to this flexed configuration right here, then it pulls the actin molecule over itself. And when it pulls the actin molecule, then the Z disks get closer together. So the power stroke is controlled by, well, I tell you what, let's go back to the previous slide over here. All right, so in a resting condition, this myosin head group is flexed, right? When ATP is hydrolyzed, as we see over here, do you see a difference in the myosin head group? What happens to it? It straightens out, it extends, right? I'd like to use those terms. I don't know if anybody else really does, but this is extension. It decreases the angle right here, so it extends, and then it can reach up and bind to actin. So, all right, so now we have ADP and inorganic phosphate in the active site of myosin. And then when inorganic phosphate is released, that causes, right, this attached crossbridge now to go back to this configuration or a flexed configuration, right? So it goes back to this configuration right now, and that pulls the actin over the myosin molecule, and we call that the power stroke. So a typical question that could be asked is, what causes the power stroke? There's one molecule, and what does it do to cause the power stroke right here. It is the release of inorganic phosphate, so we still have an ADP in the active site. Okay, so myosin can't bind to actin unless it's cocked by ATP. After binding, the myosin undergoes conformation change that we call the power stroke due to release of inorganic phosphate. All right, then after the power stroke, myosin detaches. All right, so here is the whole cycle. So let's start right here. Okay, so in this configuration, we see the myosin head group, and it is extended. It has ADP and inorganic phosphate. Under these conditions, it can bind to an actin molecule. When PI is released, all right, that causes the power stroke. And then when ADP is released, then another ATP molecule can bind to the myosin head group. And when ATP binds to the head group right here, look what happens. What happens when ATP binds? And it's not being hydrolyzed, it's just binding to the head group, then it releases from the actin molecule. All right, so the cross bridge is released when ATP binds. All right, and then this whole process starts over again. When ATP binds to the myosin head group, okay, and is hydrolyzed, then it goes from a flexed condition to an extended condition. It binds to the actin molecule, and when PI is released, that causes the flexion of the cross bridge. All right, then ADP is released, ATP joins the active site, that causes dissociation of myosin from actin, and this process repeatedly happens over and over and over again. Okay. There's a condition called rigor mortis. And probably all know what rigor mortis is. What? Who knows something about rigor mortis? Rigor mortis. In a deceased person, what happens to their muscles? They can't move, they actually contract. Okay? But for muscle contraction in our bodies, what do we need? We need ATP. Okay? So why is it that a deceased person's muscles are contracted when they're not producing ATP? How is it that those muscles can contract? That's kind of like a paradox. But this illustration right here describes why that is. Because what do you need in order to break a cross bridge from myosin to actin? You need an ATP molecule to get muscle relaxation to occur, right? So in a deceased person, there's no ATP, and since there's no ATP, these cross bridges form and can never dissociate, so that means that muscles go into contraction and they stay contracted. But if artificially you could increase the ATP concentration in a deceased person, then the muscles would relax as a result of that. Okay, so rigor mortis is understood by and can be explained by a decrease in ATP, which is going to cause these cross bridges to break and cause the muscle to relax. Okay, so that's a pretty good description of rigor mortis. Let's talk about the control of contraction. Control of cross-bridge attachment to actin is via this troponin and tropomyosin system, right? So here is an actin molecule with the globular actin or G-actin right here. Here is troponin, which is a complex of some different subunits, and then here is tropomyosin. Which one is the longer molecule? Tropomyosin is the longer molecule, okay? And it's also what? The longer word. So that might be one way to remember that tropomyosin, okay, opposed to troponin right here. Okay, and then which one did I say acts a lot like calmodulin, is a cousin molecule to calmodulin? It's troponin right here. So troponin has a binding site for calcium. Okay, so this serves as a switch for muscle contraction and muscle relaxation. All right, let's look at the next slide right here. In the relaxed state, when calcium is at a low concentration, okay, we have like in the micromolar concentration right here, there's no calcium bound to troponin, and that means that tropomyosin is covering up active sites for the myosin head group. All right, but when troponin binds calcium, hopefully we have this on the next slide right here, a little bit different. All right, so I don't see any calcium in the active site and troponin. And here is the binding site for this bump on the myosin head group. Oh, what did we call this little bump on the myosin head group? This is the actin binding site. So here's the actin binding site, and can you see that it can fit right up in here into the myosin binding site on actin? Okay, it can, but there's something in the way. What's in the way? Okay, the tropomyosin is in the way. Attached to tropomyosin is troponin. And if calcium is available, calcium can bind to that active site on troponin. And when it does, it causes a conformation chain in tropomyosin. And so now you see the myosin binding site on actin available. And myosin then forms a nice cross bridge right here. So calcium concentration within the sarcoplasm, within the myofibrils, control whether cross bridges can form. And if there's ATP present, right, then that's going to cause cycling of cross bridges and the sliding of filaments over each other. All right, so where does this calcium signal come from? This is a good question. That is going to cause these filaments to slide over each other. So there's an organelle. Where is calcium usually at a high concentration? Outside the cell, not inside, because if it's always high inside the cell, what about these muscle cells? They're always going to be contracted, right? And so that would not be useful. But calcium is at a high concentration in one other place besides extracellular, and that is smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so muscle cells have smooth endoplasmic reticulum, but just like the plasma membrane that has a special name, it's called something else inside a skeletal muscle cell, and it's called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it has a little bit different shape. So let's review this little slide that I see right here. I see a lot of nuclei. I see striations. All right, so guess what kind of cell this is? Nice skeletal muscle cell. And on this one, this is a little bit more true to life. What else do I see? Mitochondria all over the place. All right? Okay, and then we have the so here is the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It forms a network around each of these organelles for contraction. What did we call an organelle for contraction? Myofibrils, right? Myofibrils then are made up of myofilaments, and you can see the thick and thin filaments in here arranged into its bands. Oh, and if you look at this muscle cell right here, is it contracted or relaxed? And how would you know? It's relaxed. How do you know that? Because I see an I-band right here. When a muscle is contracted, the I-band goes away, right? Because it slides over the myosin filaments and the I-band disappears. All right. The who? Ah, the H is right here. See, this is a little bit lighter in the A-band, this little light region right in the middle. That's the H zone right there. Okay, so that would be another way you could tell that this muscle is relaxed. All right, so here's the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it has a nice color to it. Looks kind of, I don't know, grayish to me. Okay, green. Okay, and so here is the end of one sarcoplasmic reticulum. Here's the beginning of another, and there's something in between it. And hopefully that's not another green color. It should have the same color as the plasma membrane or the sarcolemma. Okay, these things are what we call transverse tubules. And notice that they are connected to the surface of the cell, right? So that when an action potential moves down the sarcolemma or the plasma membrane, it can trigger voltage-gated channels in these transverse tubules. So an action potential actually moves to the interior of the cell. It's not trapped on the exterior like most cells, right? So how does an action potential get distributed through the whole interior of a skeletal muscle cell? It's via the transverse tubules because they have voltage-gated channels, right? All right, and you can even see the openings to these transverse tubules on the sarcolemma right here. And when an action potential moves down the transverse tubule, it then stimulates the release of calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So the sarcoplasmic reticulum have calcium pumps that are continually pumping calcium from the sarcoplasm into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So it's always at a high concentration inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So when an action potential comes down, it opens up calcium channels. So how does calcium then move from high concentration to low concentration within the myofibril? And then it's going to interact with what molecule in the myofibril? Troponin, right? And then that causes tropomyosin to move out of the way, and then cross bridges can form, and then the filaments will slide over each other. Okay. So this probably is an exam figure. This large enlarged area right here of sarcoplasmic reticulum, we call that the terminal cisternae. So all of these are like little cisterns formed by the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And we see that there are two terminal cisternae and a transverse tubule, and sometimes we call that a triad. Is that on this slide? No, but this, is it on this slide? Don't see it, but that's sometimes what we call a triad. So there's a special interaction between the transverse tubule and these terminal cisternae here that release calcium. And what's the signal? What's the initial signal that causes release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum? It's an action potential in the transverse tubule. And where did that action potential come from? The surface of the cell. And where did that action potential come from on the surface of the cell? The neuromuscular junction, right? Okay, and of course then that's controlled by an action potential in the somatic motor neuron. Okay, so this is what we call excitation-contraction coupling, and we're going to look at it in a little bit more detail a week from today. Okay, so maybe you want to check out this slide before the next lecture, because we're going to talk about these special connections between a transverse tubule and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so next time, what do we have next time? Yeah, we have a test. Now, the test is not on muscle, right? So a lot of what we talk today is not on the test, only endocrine system.
Thank you.